It may never have come up at your house. Did anyone ask you to make a galantine or a terrine for an appetizer or a luncheon? Probably not. This episode of the Escoffier series is Chapter 11, Cold Preparations, which includes galantines and terrines. Is this a new thing to your ears? Have you heard of galantines or terrines and wondered, what is it? Did you think because it was French, it must be difficult? Well, that part may not be wrong. Learning how to make at least the basics of a pâté is a good skill to have. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 273, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here. In the course of my cooking career, I have learned and taught the finer points of garde-manger, the part of cooking that is the cold foods part of the menu. In some cases, it started out hot and is served cold. At one restaurant, during the busy season, we, the chef and I, were required to have a pâté tray of at least 5 selections, and one had to be a pâté en croûte. We'll get to that, but today we'll start with the basics. So as I mentioned, the Escoffier series continues. Now, before we get to Chapter 11, Chapter 10, as I mentioned on the last series episode, is almost only one page. The title is Composite Entrees and includes in composite entrees, and included in composite entrees are croustades, hot pies, timbales, torts, and vol-au-vent. Now, mostly those are ways to hold things. Croustades are usually served nowadays as appetizer portions. Escoffier lists 3 ways to make them. Basically, they are a shell, some kind of a starchy shell, most commonly of a pastry dough, placed in a shaped mold, docked, which means you poke holes into it, blind baked, and then cooled. Then you fill the shells with stuff. Also possible and more challenging are rice croustades and Dutch's potato croustades, which seem fit for some ring of hell. To be as confusing as possible, Escoffier mentions that there is yet one more way to make a croustade, which quickly is to make the desired shape of a slice of sandwich bread, round, oval, hard, diamond, carve a cavity into the fried bread consistent with the shape of the bread, carve a cavity in the bread, consistent with the shape, fry the bread, fill the cavity with some forcemeat, raw, cook it in a slow oven. When it is cooked, then the main course is served on top of the croustade. It's basically a super fancy crouton. A lot of work. Escoffier does offer at the top of the paragraph that these kinds of croustade have fallen into disuse. Wonder why. I don't wonder why. The other important detail of hot pies is the pastry and the filling are cooked together at the same time. The sauce is made from an essence of the main ingredient. So if it's a venison pie, you would have a venison essence, which is, we'll make it easy. It's kind of a very venison-y stock flavor, sauce. A note that he calls on some kinds, I'm getting ahead of myself. And just to remind you why cooks hate this book, especially when they do baking, the process for making a pastry includes this line. Now I'm going to note that he calls some kinds of doughs paste, but that's maybe only a translation problem. So making the dough, he writes, quote, make into a paste in the usual manner, end quote. Well, that's not enough to make the uninformed swear off baking. I don't know what else will. Now, it's not really that hard, unless, of course, you don't know the usual manner. So, chapter 11 is short, not as short as chapter 10. Chapter 11 is 11 pages, which is interesting. What's concealed in those procedures is no shortage of skills to take the craft of what is called the garmage, I mentioned, to high heights. And there really is almost no limit to how refined and sophisticated the quality of product can be. Now, this chapter includes galantines, which I mentioned, some various pies, which we're going to cover here in a minute, terrines, more appropriately called pâté aux terrines, which differentiates from pâté aux croûtes aux terrines, which is now just getting fancy, which are mostly only now called pâté aux croûtes, which is a pâté inside of a pastry, which isn't covered in here, but I will go over it in a couple of episodes. And finally, the chapter ends with some dressings and salads. Now, you could make a 1,000-page book on dressings and salads alone, but he doesn't do that. And at some point, really, it's only fair to say a vinaigrette with tarragon is still a vinaigrette if you change tarragon into chervil. It isn't a whole new recipe, for goodness sake. That's just silliness. I'm not going to go over all of that stuff now. It's too much. The skills involved in making one galantine cover pretty much all a cook will learn in the kitchen. Butchery skills and forcemeat making skills, which are a few things, and cooking skills and flavor, contrast, and compatibility are the big brush strokes of skills. Now, the work of the garde-manger is challenging and slow to ensure an excellent product. It was by far my favorite class to teach in culinary school because of the precision necessary, and the effort to achieve that excellence could be intense. And it was a great opportunity to really push the students. The single most challenging activity in garde-manger is passing the forcemeat through a screen to ensure a smooth finished product and remove all the sinews and whatever else might be in there. Now, passing it through a screen means using a bowl scraper to physically push this very thick meat paste through a literal screen. Well, anyway, that's what happens. It is not fast and it is not effortless. My favorite story about this kind of activity is when one student walked into the bake shop, shaking his hand, complaining how it was sore from passing the forcemeat. What he seemed to expect was sympathy. What he got was chuckles of amusement and fake pity. The class, you see, had just finished the garde-manger section, and every single student knew exactly what his hand felt like, and not one of them had a moment of pity or empathy for poor old student whose name is not going to be mentioned. I do remember him. The forcemeat, a somewhat unfortunate term, I'll admit, is the raw, smooth puree of meat and fat. Scafia has more than a few procedures for forcemeats, each varying for the intended use or primary ingredient. Now, we can make the process a bit easier by finding two standard recipes for nearly any situation in garde-manger calling for a forcemeat to make a pie or a pâté. Now, sausages are going to be fairly similar to the first way, but then sausages get kind of wonky because lots of other things are going on. Well, a few other things, maybe not a lot. The kind of grind for the first style of forcemeat consists of the main ingredient, let's say chicken, 50% of that weight in pork butt. So let's say you have a pound of chicken, you've got half a pound of pork butt. Now, Scoffier would say veal in some cases, but fundamentally it's The reason is the same. I'll cover that in a second. And 20 to 30% of the total weight. So we have a pound and a half, 20 to 30% of that weight of pork fat. Now, pork fat and pork meat are fairly neutral and allow the flavorings of the primary ingredient to come through. Now, when you have a chicken, which is a pretty bland meat to begin with, pork or veal, because they are both mild in flavor, aren't going to really assert themselves over the chicken. The second kind of forced meat is done in the food processor. Now, it's called forced meat mousseline, and it is smoother than the previous forced meat. It is sometimes called chicken mousse or whatever you're making mousse. Vernacular and colloquialisms sort of get hard to distinguish correct from incorrect. Technically, a chicken mousse is made with cooked chicken that is pureed, and then depending on what your final use is going to be, that chicken puree is going to have something added to it, possibly. And so again, egg yolks wouldn't work because the finished product isn't going to be cooked again. A mousse is made from already cooked stuff. Mousseline is made from uncooked stuff. So our forced meat mousseline, let's say we're using chicken again, is the smooth, much smoother than the of the two kinds of forced meats. And they respond differently to heat as well. So the ingredients for our forced meat mousseline are the primary meat, chicken, or almost any white meat and almost any fish. The clarification here is that beef would probably be a poor choice for a forced meat mousseline. Bread to bind, white bread to bind, heavy cream, and egg whites. The basic procedure is to puree the meat in the food processor until it is very smooth. Add the bread, crusts removed, puree till smooth again, add the egg whites, puree until homogenized, then pulse in the heavy cream. Now, there are ratios to all of this, and while there's some good idea ratios, here we are again, depending on what your final use is going to be, you can add more or less cream and things will happen. More cream will create a more delicate forced meat, and so the final use, we're talking here about using this as the filling for a galantine, which I'm going to explain the process. Suppose you were making you're going to make a New Year's Eve fancy past hors d'oeuvre, and you want to make chicken quenelles. Quenelle is a fancy word for what looks like a three-sided oval, and you shape it carefully with a couple of same-sized spoons, and you poach them so that the outside stays nice and soft, and then the inside, when you bite into a quenelle that has a fair amount of cream, it's very delicate. It sort of falls apart, and then you get the essence of the thing, and they're quite pretty. They're fun to make. A little tedious, but what are you going to do? So, season your forced meat mousseline with salt and pepper and flavor with spices and or herbs, and that's it. That's it, he says. The hard part is pushing the mass of stuff through a screen, just like that metal screen on your window. Now, it comes, the thing, sometimes they may look like and be used for sifting mass amounts of flour. Bakers would use them, and I did use them, to sift many pounds of powdered sugar when making the cream cheese icing. You can also sift flour if you have a lot of flour. But also, you use them, it's called a tammy, T-A-M, I think it's what I'm, T-A-M-I-S. And you can get them in, usually they're now in metal, 3-inch deep. It looks kind of like a snare drum without the bottom part of the drum. Sometimes they're made of bamboo and they have like a brass appearing, really fine mesh That's really fantastic for things like making mashed potatoes. Oh boy, howdy. Make some good mashed potatoes. But so we've laboriously passed our forced meat through the screen, and now we have our finished forced meat mousseline. If I'm making a forced meat with the grinder, I wouldn't pass it through the screen, just because I know the nature of what I'm going to get from a grinder is not going to be as smooth as a forced meat mousseline. It's just designed to be do different things. So, to make the galantines, to follow this basic procedure, bone the chicken from the back. There are two ways to do this. Remove only the skin first, then remove the meat second, or remove the meat and the skin as one thing, and then pull out the carcass. In both cases, the goal is to have the whole of the chicken skin removed and free of meat. The skin is laid out flat and stretched out, spread out, with the sternum area running vertical up and down on a piece of cling wrap on the counter or your table. So chicken, it might be 18, 20 inches. It's kind of surprisingly gets big. There are some particular challenges in either case how you do this. The leg is going to present a bit of a problem because the skin ends at the joint there. So making the smallest hole possible is the best way to go. And if you've never butchered before, or you're this is not introductory stuff. It's tedious. It's a little bit long to do. It needs a really sharp knife, but it's not impossible. Probably the easiest way to go is to take the skin off and leave the meat on the carcass, then take the skin off of that. It's a little bit easier to work with. But it can be done. The leg meat is pretty sinewy and very challenging to pass through a screen. The breast meat is good for forced meat, but also because it is such pristine quality meat with no fat and no connective tissue, some of that cut into long, uniform-ish strips will make nice garnish inside of our galantine. Some of that will really make good forced meat. As to that leg meat, the tedious thing to do, and actually this does save time, is to remove the tendons from the legs first before you make the forced meat. That's more butchering skill, which, again, isn't... I was reading a Facebook post the other day. Someone posted about sourbread dough, or sourbread in general. It said, simple, but not easy. Removing the sinews from chicken legs or duck legs or pheasant legs or partridge legs is simple, but it's not easy. It takes a little bit of practice. The fast explanation is to cut one chicken breast. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go back to the legs. Remove the sinews so you have the meat. You have the thigh meat. Take those little fat cavity inside the thigh. Pull that out. And use that for your forced meat mousseline. And when it's done, and you don't have to pass it at home, we have to think about the garnish. So we'll take one of those chicken breasts, cut them uniform-ish pieces, season them, sear them on all sides so that we want them to seize up a little bit, because they're going to shrink when they seize up, which is important. We want them to get close to their final use size. We also want to pull some of that water out of there. Additionally, the color contrast will kind of show up nice as we make this garnish. So make the forced meat. You've got your forced meat ready. You've got your garnishes ready. Your skin is laid out on a piece of plastic on the counter, and the wings and the legs are left to right. And now take some of your forced meat and place it and sort of push it flat, maybe 4 inches wide and 1 inch or so tall. And then place some of your seared chicken strips on top of that forced meat. We don't really need to worry right now about what our final design is going to be because we're still learning. And the other garnishes, wait, what? And cover with more forced meat and repeat that process until the forced meat is used. You'll have a mound of forced meat and garnish in the middle of the chicken skin. Use the plastic wrap, fold the right side over onto the forced meat. Now, it isn't going to be round. It's going to have imperfections in that, and that's okay. That's how that goes. We're going to take care of that in a minute. As you're lifting the plastic up, use your hand under the plastic and just guide the skin onto the meat and push gently so it sticks. It's going to fold probably over more than where it came off. There's less forced meat inside than there was carcass inside. So you have a little bit more skin than you did than the chicken did. It's gonna overlap. Then fold the left side over the same way. Push the skin on the forced meat a little bit. Now here's where we make up that problem a little bit. Grab both ends of the plastic wrap. By the legs and one by the top, grab them tight, and then push to roll that galantine on the counter. And what's going to happen is the plastic is going to start to crinkle up, and you're going to force that galantine to be a little bit shorter by putting pressure on the plastic and making it short. It's going to push together a little bit, which is what we want to have happen. We want to make it kind of round. So don't roll too much. Now, how much is too much? Well, that's a tough thing to know. We want to create a good shape and get a good tension on that plastic and then stop. Take a piece of butcher's twine and tie both ends as close to the galantine as you can so that it stays together. And then four or five pieces of twine around holding the round galantine kind of in shape. It's not going to hold it in shape on the counter. It's going to hold it in shape when we go to the next step. So far, so good, right? So we have our galantine rolled in plastic, tied up with string. Now we need to cook it. We're going to poach the whole thing in chicken stock. You don't have to make chicken stock. Well salted water is fine. Poach it until done, which is about 145 degrees Fahrenheit. Instead of removing the galantine from the liquid while everything is hot, turn the heat off. If you are on an electric burner, also slide the cooking vessel to the side of the stove that is cold, because electric burners retain lots of heat. Now, it will easily continue to cook 15 to 20 degrees, 15 for sure, 20 maybe, which is going to end up into our target range of 160 to 165. Now, one detail Escoffier didn't mention is the galantine will probably float. So, a wire cooling rack or two on top of the galantine in the cooking vessel will help keep it submerged. Now, part two of all this is the galantine might scorch if it's pressed too much on the bottom of the pan. So take care to not do that, and maybe by placing a cooling rack also in the bottom of the pan so that the galantine never really touches the bottom of the cooking vessel. One last detail, cook to 145. Well, how do you know that? You can't just poke a thermometer into your galantine while it's hot in the liquid. The trick is when you have the cooling racks on top, you've made a little bit of a tent and they're holding the galantine under the water while it's still cold, uncooked, in the center, near the center, pointing into the middle, push your instant read thermometer and go for the dial kind, make sure it's been calibrated. Push that in the galantine so you can read it at any given point. And that way you know when it reaches 145. The So two things. The main reason for putting it into the galantine while it's raw is as it cooks, the protein will cook around the probe and not really leak any juice out. If you poke into a galantine while it's hot, it's like poking into a steak while it's hot. You've made a hole for the juices to escape, which they will do with great speed, and you can't put them back. So if you make the hole to begin with before it's cooked, you eliminate that problem. And does some come out? Perhaps. I've never really noticed it being a big problem compared to what happens if you poke when it's hot. That becomes a really big problem. Plus, it's much harder to do. Those digital ones might work. They turn off, which is no big deal. They'll turn back on. My only concern would be that maybe the plastic would melt or it gets in the water and then the whole thing is ruined and they're kind of spendy to be kind of ruined. Now, we've covered a lot. Here's where home cooking and restaurant cooking are substantially different. In a restaurant, the whole entire contraption, when it has carried up to its final temperature, is placed in the walk-in to cool down. This whole big pan, thermometer and everything, goes right into the walk-in. And we let it cool down. Get down to 40 degrees. A galantine is today for tomorrow, at least. A galantine is never today for today. It takes a lot of time to make and cool and to be ready to slice. Now, Escoffier does go through, and I've reread the part on galantines again just to see, refresh myself, and there was a detail I seem to have overlooked for 20 years. In all the years I've been making galantines, never once did I press it. Now, a tureen, tureens made in a, usually we would use an earthenware cooking vessel, and we would cut a piece of cardboard just the right size of the top, wrap it in foil, then plastic wrap, and then a brick, so that goes on, and then a brick or a couple of cans goes on top of the tureen to press it. And part of that, the principal purpose is to compact the forcemeat into something firm and compact. With a galantine, you have this round thing. Pressing it, obviously, is going to change its shape, something we prefer to avoid. So I asked a friend of mine, a chef, who also has made galantines, and he said never once has he done that, never even heard of it, and suggested that perhaps something over time has changed and what we do now is different than what Escoffier did then. I don't know, but I've never pressed one and don't see any reason to start. A galantine can be made out of any bird. However, the effort and reward for a chicken galantine or a duck galantine and a quail galantine is not the same. If you're going to make one, make it big enough that the finished product justifies the effort, and a quail galantine is not going to do that. As to the other garnish part, there's nearly no limit to what other garnishes can go in galantines, and you can think about that sort of like pâtés and also sausages. Color is good with flavor, and pistachios are a popular choice. They hold their color. They're a good complement. They're fairly neutral in flavor. I do add slightly different texture. They are pretty to look at, and they taste good. Dried diced apricots or diced dried apricots and dried fruit of almost any kind is a good choice. Any meat that is added should at least be seared. Chicken livers or foie gras, well, all right, so chicken livers should be seared to get a good color, and you want to season them up. Chicken liver has a lot of water in there. Foie gras, it should also be seared a little bit, but remember, searing foie gras is like searing butter. It's worth doing. It's hard to do, but it's worth doing, especially going into the pâté, and you save the fat for something, maybe even going into the tureen or the galantine. Mushrooms must be cooked. Truffles are great additions. Almost any herb and or spice mixture works. Contrasts are nice. Venison garnish and a chicken galantine opens up some strong spice flavoring compatibility, particularly lavender leaves and juniper. Venison also brings in the possibility of adding chestnuts, which don't have color contrast and don't actually have texture contrast, but they have flavor contrast. So there's lots of ways to go, lots of interesting opportunities, and cookbooks can give you ideas of what will or wouldn't work. And then, you know, you think, man, does that taste good? Does that sound like it tastes good? And then that's how you build your palette repertoire of things that go together, either complement or contrast. So this galantine's been cooled. We're taking it out of the liquid, taking it out of the plastic, cutting all the strings off. Now we have this cooked round chicken skin thing with stuff inside. Now, the very, very ends are snacks for the cook or whoever wants them. Service for escoffier would include diced aspic of the principal ingredient, so a chicken aspic. Basically, it's chicken consomme that's been reduced to become aspic and nice and clear. And aspic was a big thing back in the 70s, both probably 18 and 1970s. I haven't seen it much lately, but well, it's basically meat jello, and I kind of like it. But I think probably most people are a little bit weirded out by that. In addition to aspic cubes, something tart, a good pickle, or a really great green mustard, horseradishy something or other would be good. Toast points are generally good accompaniments because they have crisp and it's a vessel on which to carry the piece of terrine or pate. As we continue chapter 11, we'll cover meat pies. Now that winter is here, that seems a good thing to learn how to make. For now, we're going to stop here because I feel this is almost overwhelming in content and concept. It's like, wait a minute, too much. Meat pies are tasty, and they make a good lunch the next day. If you're familiar with something called a pasty, and if you're in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, that's just every day, it's basically just a handheld version of meat pie. Now, I realize probably Wisconsin and maybe even parts of New York and Pennsylvania know what a pasty is. Big deals for the miners, but good food, good stuff. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll be taking the next two Mondays off, Christmas Day and New Year's Day. There are plenty of things in the old archive there to catch up on. And that includes making your New Year's Eve ice cream. I think I put a link up for ice cream base. There's certainly Christmas cookies to make. I'll put a link for a Christmas cookie. There's something somewhere in there. I think it's a PDF for a couple of different kinds of Christmas cookies. It's just, you know, sweet things to have for the next couple of weeks, and then we all get back on diets. I hope you have a fabulous Christmas or whatever you celebrate, and a happy new year. And I'll see you next year.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.